This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. David McCullough is here. He is one of America's most celebrated historians and the multiple Pulitzer Prize-winning author of 1776, John Adams and Truman, among many others. But in his latest book, McCullough takes the arc of 19th century American history and traces how it bends through a foreign land, and one foreign city in particular, Paris. The book is The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. David McCullough, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much.
You know, your book is just a marvelous journey that documents the adventures of many influential Americans beginning in 1830, including Elizabeth Blackwell, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., James Fenimore Cooper, Mary Cassatt. But in the time we have, I was wondering if we might focus our conversation on one American in particular, a Bostonian at that, and that's Charles Sumner. Because you open your book in describing Sumner at the age of 23 in the 1830s, headed towards Paris, and you describe him as he stood a gaunt 6'2" with his sonorous voice and serious brow. He appeared beyond his 20s. So tell us, what was it that the then later very famous U.S. senator, what was it that took him to Paris as a young man?
Well, my criteria included that these people that I write about be those who went on a quest, ambitious to excel or to improve themselves in a given field that they had chosen. They weren't going for money or power or fame. And Sumner is particularly interesting because he was going because he felt he simply didn't know enough. Mm. He had graduated from Harvard. He'd gone to the Harvard Law School and opened a law office in Boston for about 2 or 3 years, and then he decided, I just don't know enough. I'm not sufficiently educated. As an American, one could go to Paris and attend the lectures at the Sorbonne for nothing. France had this policy that any foreign student could attend the medical school or the great university of the Sorbonne for no fee. So if you could get there, you could do it, and he wanted to go attend the lectures at the Sorbonne.
Well, before we get to what he learned at the Sorbonne, I'm wondering if we could maybe explore a little bit about how Paris in the 1830s, what kind of city that it was. I mean, to this day, many Europeans, for example, come to Boston and find something very familiar here in the city. Was Paris as familiar to Bostonians then in the 1830s?
No, Bostonians, most of them had never set foot out of the country. They knew nothing about a foreign culture. They had no experience with a foreign culture. Very few of them spoke a word of French, because French wasn't yet taught much in colleges and universities, and they'd never been to sea, and they had to cross the Atlantic Ocean on sailing ships, which were not passenger ships. They were freight boats, and you booked passage on a freight boat, and it was a month at best, miserable food. Nothing to do. So you had to want to go there. And Sumner went to the Sorbonne, attended lectures in every conceivable subject, managed to learn French in record time by cramming and tutoring and cramming almost night and day. And he loved it. He loved every month of it. And he came back with an idea that had changed him and which ultimately changed our story as a country.
Hold on to that thought for just a moment, because I do want, that is the crux of Mr. Sumner's story, and I want to get to it, but I want to lay the groundwork a little bit, as you do in the book, about what it was about Americans in Paris that led him to that revelation that he had. I mean, for example, you write that Paris in the 1830s was a city of 800,000 people, and it was one that, to American eyes, was also one of extremes and variability. I mean, I was delighted how you quoted James Fenimore Cooper saying that Paris was both a city of dirt and gilding, bedbugs and lace. That's maybe not something that you think of Paris today as one of such extremes.
Well, it was extremes of great poverty and great finery and extravagant, magnificent architecture. They'd never seen anything like the theater, the opera. They had never eaten such meals. Wine was cheaper than milk. they had never really been in a big, vibrant city, the cultural capital of the world. Paris then was to the world what New York would be to the world after World War II. It was the place to be, particularly in the arts and particularly in the world of ideas and science and medicine, medical capital of the world. And, of course, it was also a place where one could do things that you simply couldn't do at home. There were no schools of architecture here. There were no schools of art here. There were no museums with paintings. So if you want to be an artist, you could go and look at the great masterpieces, which was impossible here.
And in fact, you even quote Sumner himself visiting the Louvre and looking upon works of Raphael and Leonardo and with what he called a thrill of a great awakening because he'd never seen such works.
It was
before.
A great awakening. And Sumner had one of the great awakenings of his life. At the Sorbonne, he noticed that the black students were treated exactly as everyone else. They dressed the same, they talked the same, and they had the same aspirations as he had and the others had. And he wrote in his journal, and his journal is one of the great treasures of our story as a country. He wrote in his journal, "I wonder if the way we treat black people at home has more to do with what we've been taught and is not part of the natural order of things." And this was a revelation for him. It was an epiphany for him. And he had shown no sympathy for, no spirit of fellow human beings before toward black people.
I mean, this was a complete change for him.
It was one of those riveting moments of realization.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but it's just that you have in the book you've quoted at some length Sumner's actual diary on the day that he noted this, and it's a beautiful passage. So if I may read it, to share with everyone, here's Charles Sumner writing on January 20th, 1838. He writes, "They," these being the black students, "were standing in the midst of a knot of young men, and their color seemed to be no objection to them. I was glad to see this, though with American impressions it seemed very strange. It must be then that the distance between free blacks and whites among us is derived from education and does not exist in the nature of things." And beforehand, as you noted, Charles Sumner, you know, basically had previously written before he left the United States that he didn't see black Americans as having any intelligence whatsoever.
No, and he henceforth dedicated his life to the abolition of slavery. He became a member of the United States Senate when he was still in his early 40s from Massachusetts and became the most powerful voice for abolition in the United States Congress, to the point where it nearly cost him his life. He was attacked on the floor of the Senate from behind by an irate Southern congressman, Preston Brooks, who beat him with a heavy gutta-percha walking stick, boasted afterward of hitting him 30 times, breaking the stick over Sumner's back and head. And Sumner never really recovered from that attack, either psychologically or physically. And that attack, when word of that attack reached John Brown and his people out in Kansas, they then committed what's known as the Pottawatomie Massacre, where they attacked and killed a number of innocent people in their outrage of what had happened to Sumner. So this incident on the floor of the Senate had rapidly mushroomed into a national calamity, which, of course, then just fueled all the heat that was building toward the Civil War. So this one young man's observation in a lecture hall in Paris at the Sorbonne was like a drop in the pond that sent out these ripple effects that we still feel today. And there is Charles Sumner standing in the public garden here in Boston, marvelous statue of him. And all it says is Sumner. And I doubt that there's one Bostonian in 1,000 who walks by there and has any idea who he was. They probably think he built the Sumner Tunnel. Which he had nothing to do with the Sumner Tunnel. On the day he died here in Boston in 1874, his body had been lying in state at the State House on Beacon Hill. It was then taken to Mount Auburn Cemetery, a distance of 5 miles, and the crowds lined that whole route. The whole city shut down. And now, unfortunately, he's forgotten. And he shouldn't be forgotten. He's one of those Americans we all should know about.
He's a giant of American history.
Yes, he was. And a wonderfully interesting man. Intellectually invigorating, stimulating, great curiosity, spectacular speaker, and a great friend, very close friend of Longfellow, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., a whole group of Bostonians of such distinction as seldom happened anywhere, let alone in this city.
Well, David McCullough, one of the most fascinating things that just rung out to me as I was reading your book was that you note in the 1830s there were fewer or approximately 1,000 Americans of the type of Charles Sumner visiting Paris. We've just got a tiny bit of time left, but when you think of the impact that that Parisian experience had on Sumner and then the other 900 plus, here's a city that whose influence just rings through the rest of American history in ways that we can't even begin to imagine.
Well, in every field, in art, in music, in the dance, in literature, Henry James, Henry Adams, Mary Cassatt, John Singer Sargent, an Irish boy from Boston named George Healy, who became the eminent portrait painter of the day on both sides of the Atlantic. Seven of his portraits hang in the White House today. It's an amazing story, and nobody had covered this period between 1830 and 1900. So for me, it was an exciting adventure in itself.
And may I just ask you briefly about your own love affair with Paris?
Well, it began when I was a teenager growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and our local hero was Gene Kelly, who'd gone to the same high school as my older brother. And, of course, he went dancing through Paris in the famous American in Paris movie, which had a great effect on me. At that point, I wanted to be a painter. And there was Gene Kelly dancing in Paris, painting with all these wonderful-looking women. And then later I went to Paris. My wife and I went to Paris just 50 years ago this year, and we have been going back repeatedly ever since, and in many cases to do research for my books. The Truman book, the Adams book, and my Panama book all have required a research in France.
Well, this book is The Greater Journey, Americans in Paris. It is an absolutely outstanding read. David McCullough, thank you so much for joining us today.
I appreciate the chance to talk with you. Thank you.
Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at boston.com. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.